This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Robin Cotter, Toronto, Ontario, December 2006. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Chapter 6, Part 3. On the 9th of November, the Houses met. The Commons were summoned to the bar of the Lords, and the King spoke from the throne. His speech had been composed by himself. He congratulated his loving subjects on the suppression of the rebellion in the West, but he added that the speed with which that rebellion had risen to a formidable height, and the length of time during which it had continued to rage, must convince all men how little dependence could be placed on the militia. He had, therefore, made additions to the regular army. The charge of that army would henceforth be more than double of what it had been, and he trusted that the Commons would grant him the means of defraying the increased expense. He then informed his hearers that he had employed some officers who had not taken the test, but he knew them to be fit for public trust. He feared that artful men might avail themselves of this irregularity to disturb the harmony which existed between himself and his Parliament. But he would speak out. He was determined not to part with servants on whose fidelity he could rely, and whose help he might perhaps soon need. This explicit declaration that he had broken the laws which were regarded by the nation as the chief safeguards of the established religion, and that he was resolved to persist in breaking those laws, was not likely to soothe the excited feelings of his subjects. The Lords, seldom disposed to take the lead in opposition to a government, consented to vote him formal thanks for what he had said. But the Commons were in a less complying mood. When they had returned to their own house, there was a long silence, and the faces of many of the most respectable members expressed deep concern. At length, Middleton rose and moved the House to go instantly into committee on the King's speech, but Sir Edmund Jennings, a zealous Tory from Yorkshire, who was supposed to speak the sentiments of Danby, protested against this course and demanded time for consideration. Sir Thomas Clarges, maternal uncle of the Duke of Albemarle, and long distinguished in Parliament as a man of business and a vigilant steward of the public money, took the same side. The feeling of the House could not be mistaken. Sir John Ernley, Chancellor of the Exchequer, insisted that the delay should not exceed 48 hours, but he was overruled, and it was resolved that the discussion should be postponed for 3 days. The interval was well employed by those who took the lead against the court. They had indeed no light work to perform. In 3 days a country party was to be organized. The difficulty of the task is in our age not easily to be appreciated, for in our age all the nation may be said to assist at every deliberation of the Lords and Commons. What is said by the leaders of the ministry and of the opposition after midnight is read by the whole metropolis at dawn, by the inhabitants of Northumberland and Cornwall in the afternoon, and in Ireland and the Highlands of Scotland on the morrow. In our age, therefore, the stages of legislation, the rules of debate, the tactics of faction, the opinions, temper, and style of every active member of either house are familiar to hundreds of thousands. Every man who now enters Parliament possesses what, in the 17th century, would have been called a great stock of parliamentary knowledge. Such knowledge was then to be obtained only by actual parliamentary service. The difference between an old and a new member was as great as the difference between a veteran soldier and a recruit just taken from the plough, and James's Parliament contained a most unusual proportion of new members, who had brought from their country seats to Westminster no political knowledge and many violent prejudices. These gentlemen hated the Papists, but hated the Whigs not less intensely, and regarded the king with superstitious veneration. To form an opposition out of such materials was a feat which required the most skilful and delicate management. Some men of great weight, however, undertook the work and performed it with success. Several experienced Whig politicians, who had not seats in that Parliament, gave useful advice and information. On the day preceding that which had been fixed for the debate, many meetings were held, at which the leaders instructed the novices, and it soon appeared that these exertions had not been thrown away. The foreign embassies were all in a ferment. It was well understood that a few days would now decide the great question, whether the King of England was or was not to be the vassal of the King of France. The ministers of the House of Austria were most anxious that James should give satisfaction to his Parliament. Innocent had sent to London two persons charged to inculcate moderation, both by admonition and by example. One of them was John Leyburn, an English Dominican who had been secretary to Cardinal Howard, and who, with some learning and a rich vein of natural humour, was the most cautious, dexterous, and taciturn of men. He had recently been consecrated Bishop of Adrumetum, and named Vicar Apostolic in Great Britain. Ferdinand, Count of Adda, an Italian of no eminent abilities, but of mild temper and courtly manners, had been appointed nuncio. These functionaries were eagerly welcomed by James. No Roman Catholic bishop had exercised spiritual functions in the island during more than half a century. No nuncio had been received here during the 127 years which had elapsed since the death of Mary. Leyburn was lodged in Whitehall and received a pension of £1,000 a year. Adda did not yet assume a public character. He passed for a foreigner of rank whom curiosity had brought to London, appeared daily at court, and was treated with high consideration. Both the papal emissaries did their best to diminish, as much as possible, the odium inseparable from the offices which they filled, and to restrain the rash zeal of James. The nuncio, in particular, declared that nothing could be more injurious to the interests of the Church of Rome than a rupture between the king and the Parliament. Barillon was active on the other side. The instructions which he received from Versailles in this occasion well deserved to be studied, for they furnish a key to the policy systematically pursued by his master towards England during the 20 years which preceded our revolution. The advices for Madrid, Lewis wrote, were alarming. Strong hopes were entertained there that James would ally himself closely with the House of Austria, as soon as he should be assured that his Parliament would give him no trouble. In these circumstances, it was evidently the interest of France that the Parliament should prove refractory. Barillon was therefore directed to act with all possible precautions against detection, the part of a make-bait. At court he was to omit no opportunity of stimulating the religious zeal and the kingly pride of James, but at the same time it might be desirable to have some secret communication with the malcontents. Such communication would indeed be hazardous and would require the utmost adroitness, yet it might perhaps be in the power of the ambassador, without committing himself or his government, to animate the zeal of the opposition for the laws and liberties of England, and to let it be understood that those laws and liberties were not regarded by his master with an unfriendly eye. Lewis, when he dictated these instructions, did not foresee how speedily and how completely his uneasiness would be removed by the obstinacy and stupidity of James. On the 12th of November, the House of Commons resolved itself into a committee on the royal speech. The Solicitor General Heneage Finch was in the chair. The debate was conducted by the chiefs of the new country party with rare tact and address. No expression indicating disrespect to the sovereign or sympathy for rebels was suffered to escape. The Western insurrection was always mentioned with abhorrence. Nothing was said of the barbarities of Kirke and Jeffreys. It was admitted that the heavy expenditure which had been occasioned by the late troubles justified the king in asking some further supply, but strong objections were made to the augmentation of the army and to the infraction of the Test Act. The subject of the Test Act the courtiers appear to have carefully avoided. They harangued, however, with some force on the great superiority of a regular army to a militia. One of them tauntingly asked whether the defense of the kingdom was to be entrusted to the beef-eaters. Another said that he should be glad to know how the Devonshire train bands, who had fled in confusion before Monmouth's scythemen, would have faced the household troops of Lewis. But these arguments had little effect on cavaliers who still remembered with bitterness the stern rule of the Protector. The general feeling was forcibly expressed by the first of the Tory country gentlemen of England, Edward Seymour. He admitted that the militia was not in a satisfactory state, but maintained that it might be remodeled. The remodeling might require money, but for his own part, he would rather give a million to keep up a force from which he had nothing to fear, than half a million to keep up a force of which he must ever be afraid. Let the train bands be disciplined. Let the navy be strengthened, and the country would be secure. A standing army was at best a mere drain on the public resources. The soldier was withdrawn from all useful labor. He produced nothing. He consumed the fruits of the industry of other men, and he domineered over those by whom he was supported. But the nation was now threatened, not only with a standing army, but with a popish standing army, with a standing army officered by men who might be very amiable and honorable, but who were on principle enemies to the constitution of the realm. Sir William Twisden, member for the County of Kent, spoke on the same side with great keenness and loud applause. Sir Richard Temple, one of the few Whigs who had a seat in that Parliament, dexterously accommodating his speech to the temper of his audience, reminded the House that a standing army had been found, by experience, to be as dangerous to the just authority of princes as to the liberty of nations. Sir John Maynard, the most learned lawyer of his time, took part in the debate. He was now more than 80 years old, and could well remember the political contests of the reign of James I. He had sat in the Long Parliament, and had taken part with the Roundheads, but had always been for lenient counsels, and had labored to bring about a general reconciliation. His abilities, which age had not impaired, and his professional knowledge, which had long overawed all Westminster Hall, commanded the ear of the House of Commons. He, too, declared himself against the augmentation of the regular forces. After much debate, it was resolved that a supply should be granted to the Crown, but it was also resolved that a bill should be brought in for making the militia more efficient. This last resolution was tantamount to a declaration against the standing army. The king was greatly displeased, and it was whispered that if things went on thus, the session would not be of long duration. On the morrow, the contention was renewed. The language of the country party was perceptibly bolder and sharper than on the preceding day. That paragraph of the king's speech which related to supply preceded the paragraph which related to the test. On this ground, Middleton proposed that the paragraph relating to supply should be first considered in committee. The opposition moved the previous question. They contended that the reasonable and constitutional practice was to grant no money till grievances had been redressed, and that there would be an end of this practice if the House thought itself bound servilely to follow the order in which matters were mentioned by the King from the throne. The division was taken on the question whether Middleton's motion should be put. The noes were ordered by the Speaker to go forth into the lobby. They resented this much, and complained loudly of his servility and partiality, for they conceived that, according to the intricate and subtle rule which was then in force, and which, in our time, was superseded by a mere rational and convenient practice, they were entitled to keep their seats, and it was held by all the parliamentary tacticians in that age that the party which stayed in the House had an advantage over the party which went out, for the accommodation on the benches was then so deficient that no person who had been fortunate enough to get a good seat was willing to lose it. Nevertheless, to the dismay of the ministers, many persons on whose votes the court had absolutely depended were seen moving towards the door. Among them was Charles Fox, paymaster of the forces, and son of Sir Stephen Fox, clerk of the Green Cloth. The paymaster had been induced by his friends to absent himself during part of the discussion, but his anxiety had become insupportable. He came down to the Speaker's chamber, heard part of the debate, withdrew, and after hesitating for an hour or two between conscience and £5,000 a year, took a manly resolution and rushed into the House just in time to vote. Two officers of the army, Colonel John Darcy, son of the Lord Conyers, and Captain James Kendall, withdrew to the lobby. Middleton went down to the bar and expostulated warmly with them. He particularly addressed himself to Kendall, a needy retainer of the court, who had, in obedience to the royal mandate, been sent to Parliament by a packed corporation in Cornwall, and who had recently obtained a grant of 100 head of rebels sentenced to transportation. "Sir," said Middleton, "have not you a troop of horse in His Majesty's service?" "Yes, my lord," answered Kendall, "but my elder brother is just dead, and has left me 700 a year." When the tellers had done their office, it appeared that the ayes were 182, and the noes 183. In that House of Commons, which had been brought together by the unscrupulous use of chicanery, of corruption, and of violence, in that House of Commons of which James had said that more than 11/12 of the members were such as he would himself have nominated, the court had sustained a defeat on a vital question. End of Part 3.